This is a reading of a cycle of lectures by Rudolf Steiner entitled The Evolution of the World and of Humanity from 1923. This is Lecture 11. When we turn back to what was described yesterday, we must realize that man, as he lives through the different times that succeed one another after physical death, the word in quotes time is used here in accordance with physical customs, first enters the region of the moon beings, and passes from thence into that of the sun beings. The moon beings still belong in a certain respect to earth existence, and the experiences through which man passes in the soul world under the influence of these moon beings are at the same time cosmic recollections of earth life. He passes retrospectively through the earth life in real experiences, but with the addition of that which I yesterday called the intervention of the cosmic judgments. These cosmic judgments are brought to man after death by these moon beings. He comes under their influence. When man enters the spiritual cosmic existence after death, he acquires first the cosmic perceptions, which still proceed from beings once connected with the earth. We learned also that these beings, who afterward took up their residence in a cosmic citadel in the moon, themselves were once teachers of humanity in the oldest mysteries of the earth, and later withdrew to this moon dwelling, if I may so express it. Thus man, in his passage through the soul world, experiences the influence of these beings, with whom he actually lived on earth in remotest ages, these beings now exalted, if I may put it so, to form the population of the moon. We may very well make use of this expression if we bear in mind what I mentioned in the last lecture, that these moon inhabitants, under the leadership of the beings who were once the leaders of man, possess an entirely different judgment from that common to the inhabitants of earth. These latter are only now undergoing, in their earthly existence, between birth and death, what the moon inhabitants went through in long past ages. Reckoning according to earthly time, these moon inhabitants experienced during their earthly existence more than 15,000 years ago what humanity still has to undergo. More than 15,000 years ago they acquired a power of judgment in which the naturalistic and moral aspects flowed harmoniously together. We, on earth today, keep in watertight compartments the natural scientific opinions we form about stones and animals. In judging of them, we withhold all moral judgments. We say nature alone obeys a moral necessity. The whole world, however, is not guided by moral necessity. Although the separate animals, plants, and especially minerals, considered in their several existences, should not be judged by applying a moral judgment to them, yet their creation, and the fact that they are in the world, is absolutely the result of cosmic moral judgments. The moon population possesses this moral judgment. When we have passed through the gates of death, we, together with these beings, must listen to what the cosmos says concerning that which we on earth have thought, desired, felt, willed, and done. The whole of our earthly life is, as it were, viewed in the light of cosmic judgment. We then learn how much value to the whole universe is that which we have accomplished on earth. As a result of these experiences, we develop the impulse to complete, correct, or put right in some way what we have done, either to promote or hinder the world's development. While we are under the influence of the moon inhabitants, we receive the impulses for our destiny in the earth lives to follow, for what Eastern wisdom has always called karma. The impulses of karma are received at the time when men stand under the influence of the moon inhabitants, who inform him of the value of his earth actions and earth thoughts for the whole cosmos. The spiritual beings of the higher world, who live in the environment of men, while they are under the influence of the moon inhabitants, are those I have summarized in my esoteric science as the beings of the first hierarchy, Angeloi, Arch, Angeloi, and Arch Kai. They are the first order of beings into whose domain man enters, who have not, as a phase of their lives, to pass through an earthly incarnation. First hierarchy, angels, archangels, archai. These beings, on their part, stand in inner relation with the beings of the higher hierarchies. But while man, during his moon existence after death, is essentially in relation with the beings of this hierarchy, he hardly notices anything as yet of the hierarchies. The judgment of the angels, as regards the value of the actions of individuals, are of special importance. After his death, man learns from the angels the value of his own personal actions to the whole cosmos. From the archangels, he learns rather the value of his actions by reason of his speaking certain languages and belonging to a particular nation. These things are also involved in the impulses for his further destiny, his further karma. And from the archai, man learns what the value of the deeds he accomplishes at a particular epoch will be to the epoch into which he will have to descend again into earthly existence from spiritual heights. By means of all that a man can rightly acquire in the way of preparation for his extra-earthly existence, I hope you will take this remark quite seriously, through what he can absorb of the impulses thus given, and especially, as we shall see later, through his attitude to the great spiritual teachers of humanity, he can find the bridge leading from the sphere of the moon inhabitants to that of the sun inhabitants. Thus, in speaking of the worlds man enters between death and a new birth, we must refer to a moon population and a sun population. The former consists, as we have seen, of those beings who at one time had their dwelling place on the earth and were connected with the earth. The sun inhabitants were, however, also connected with the earth and took part in its affairs, but at a very much earlier epoch. When a man enters the region of the moon inhabitants, it is perfectly clear to him that he is there among beings with whom he once lived on the earth. When he enters the region of the sun inhabitants, he is overcome by a mighty cosmic recollection of an ancient primeval age. I have described this in title Esoteric Science from a different aspect. He is aware of something like a memory of a primeval time, when the sun was still one with the earth, and the sun inhabitants were still bound up with the earth. After death, when we grow into the spiritual cosmos, we grow into two spiritual cosmic countries, with the inhabitants of which we were once in relation on earth, when we ourselves were as yet quite different beings. When we pass through the experiences that fall to our lot between death and a new birth, we look back in great cosmic memories from the present epoch of humanity to the evolution of the earth in the universe. During man's life here on earth, he only goes through one part of his evolution. But between death and a new birth, he travels through the entire collective cosmic evolution of the world. Thus the sun inhabitants are essentially those who not only rose beyond the experiences possible to earth beings at a very much more remote period, but also ascended beyond the experiences possible to inhabitants of the moon. When a man enters the region of the sun dwellers, he enters a sphere of the highest wisdom, a sphere in which it is only possible for him to live if he has prepared himself for this in an adequate way while on earth. Now, as I told you yesterday, when man passes from the soul world into the spirit land, and, as we must now say, from the sphere of the moon dwellers into that of the sun dwellers, he slows down considerably the tempo of his traveling through the cosmos. Thus, whereas he travels through the cycle of the moon in about a third of the time of his earthly life, he travels through the following ones, through Mars, Jupiter, and Saturn, at a much slower rate, though, as I mentioned yesterday, he does not travel completely through these. His journey through these planetary cycles is accomplished at a 12 times slower rate than the cycle of the moon. If we reckon up what this amounts to, we come to the following result. We must begin with what was originally destined for man by the decision of the cosmos, that his moon time should last as long as 1/3 of his earth time. If we add the longer sleeping time of early childhood to the later periods of a man's sleep during his earth life, we find they amount to a total of about 30 years, which is approximately the time he requires to complete his first cycle, the moon cycle. Each of the following cycles will take 12 times longer, so that we get 360 years for each cycle. Then if we follow man further and further in his cosmic traveling, we find he accomplishes 3 cycles. He does not get as far as Saturn, but it was originally intended that he should complete these 3. We may therefore say, man travels through cycle 1, cycle 2, cycle 3, and must then pass back again through the 3 cycles. He accomplishes 3 cycles in his outward journey and 3 on the return route into his next earth life. That makes 6 cycles. Thus we can sum up the time that the cosmic council originally intended man to take over his journeying as 2,160 years. I still have to explain that he does not always do this, for things have changed a great deal for modern man, but that was more or less the allotted time. 2,160 years. What does this signify? You need only remember that every year the vernal point of the sun occupies a different place in the zodiac. It progresses. It has so progressed during the last centuries that while it was originally in Aries, it progressed a little further and still a little further in Aries, and then passed into Pisces. And in about 25,900 years, almost 26,000 years, the sun will have completed the whole cycle of the zodiac. Now, 2,160 years is 1/12 of this period. In 2,160 years, the sun has progressed from one zodiacal sign into the next. Thus it was originally intended that a man should return to the earth when the sun has progressed from one sign of the zodiac to the next. So you see, if we arrive at the number 2,160, reckoning by inner reasoning, and compare it with what I have stated in Esoteric Science from a quite different point of view, those who have read the book will recollect that I gave the time of the progression of the sun from one side of the zodiac to the next as the time originally intended for man to spend between death and rebirth. Comparing these 2 aspects, the one calculating the number as coming from without and the other which I have given today as reckoned from the inner life of man, one arrives at exactly the same total. These are the things that man should begin to observe, that when one begins to form right judgments in spiritual science from one aspect, and then to form right judgments from an entirely different aspect, they will inwardly coincide. It is very easy for anyone judging spiritual science, according to the opinion of today, to say, quote, on what is your spiritual science founded? Our modern science is based on observation, on experiments. It starts from that, and there we have solid ground. Close quote. A person talking like that about the things brought forward today might just as well say, quote, when I stand as man on the earth, I stand on solid ground. A block of stone lies outside there, and it lies on solid ground. Everything on earth rests on solid ground. Your astronomers are simply visionaries, and for they tell us that the earth floats freely in heavenly space. They ought to tell us that the earth itself rests like a rock on solid ground, if they wish to be logical. That is more or less the opinion of those who say of anthroposophy that it has no solid foundation. Of course, it would be ridiculous to say the earth ought to rest like a rock on solid ground, but they do not realize that it is just as ridiculous not to perceive that anything that has inner support, as the heavenly bodies have, cannot depend upon experiment or explanation. If people would only be logical in their opinions, they would soon see that the spiritual science here intended takes each step forward in the most exact way possible, and in each step takes fully into account the judgment it seeks to establish concerning the cosmos and cosmic beings. Thus, after his death, man enters a world in which he lives at first in the company of those souls who, like himself, have experienced an earth existence, and being disembodied on passing through the gates of death, find themselves translated into the spiritual world just described. Man makes his way into the sphere of the disembodied human beings, and with them continues in the spiritual world the intercourse he had when they all lived on earth. Now, as we have seen, man also enters a company of other spiritual beings, the community of the moon inhabitants, who were also at one time inhabitants of earth with him, and he subsequently ascends to the community of the sun inhabitants, who also once inhabited the earth with him, though in very much more remote ages. There he first finds himself in company with the beings composing the second hierarchy. In esoteric science I have designated these as exousiae, dynamis, and curiotities. These are the beings with whom man must work in order to be able, in his next earth life, to represent, to manifest, what he prepared in earlier earth lives as his destiny, his karma, which he has, in a manner of speaking, cosmically worked out. Second hierarchy, exousiae, called spirits of form, dynamis, called spirits of motion, curiotities, called spirits of wisdom. When we have passed through the region of the moon dwellers, we are aware, not of course in our earthly thoughts, but in our cosmic ones, of what we have done, which, in the cosmic sense, was not right. We then know the value for the whole of cosmic evolution of what we did and thought and felt. But we cannot prepare a new earth existence if we only realize this with cosmic thoughts. In the moon sphere, we can acquire the knowledge of what we must become in our next earth existence, but we cannot there prepare that existence. For that we must ascend to the sun sphere, where dwell the beings who have now nothing more to do with earth existence, but who attend to the affairs of the whole planetary system. Concealed in the cosmos, in the sphere of what man has to experience there, are two spiritual lands with their spiritual population. The cosmos has, concealed within it, the soul world of the moon population, and the more comprehensive population of the spirit land, the land of the sun. While the moon population was, not so very long ago, in a cosmic sense, connected with the earth, and still makes the interests of earth people its own, for the moon is simply a cosmic colony from which it works and directs the concerns of earth, the sun universe, in which dwell the sun population under the leadership of the exousiae, dynamis, and curiotities, is a universe in the cosmos which has to attend to the affairs of the whole planetary system, Mars, Saturn, Jupiter, Venus, etc., as well as Earth and Moon. On entering the sun universe, we enter a sphere in which our interests are greatly extended, and in which we are able, in cooperation with exousiae, dynamis, and curiotities, to prepare for the coming into existence of the spirit germ of a physical body, which can then be brought to birth through the parents. No parents could bring forth a physical body suitable for us unless it had been prepared and worked at for long periods of time, as the work of very high and exalted spiritual beings in the spiritual cosmos. Our own work in that cosmos essentially consists in this, and it is truly greater and more comprehensive to work together with these beings of high degree than to accomplish what we do in our little earth existence. We take part in all the spiritual events which play a part in these beings, just as the phenomena of nature do here, in the spiritual art which plays a part in them, just as the art in nature does in us. We are finally able to link all this together into a mighty cosmic archetype, which is the spiritual germ, and in a sense the advance shadow of what is to be born on earth as our physical body. When man has completed the three cycles and begun his return journey, his interest in the affairs of earth comes back to him, and he then looks down many years before he is born upon the generations in course of earthly evolution, and at the end of which stand his father and mother. Even as early as the time of man's great turning point in the cosmos, he begins to direct his attention down to the earth. He then looks down at the remote ancestors, from whom will descend sons and daughters, and from these again sons and daughters, and so on, until centuries later the two parents are born, to whom he can send down in diminutive size that which as a more mighty and comprehensive spirit germ was formed for the physical body in the physical world, in order that this spirit germ should then unite with the physical germ within the body of the mother. This spirit germ is at first as majestic and as large as the universe itself. When man begins his return journey to the physical world and contemplates the generations from which his parents are to descend, and from the spiritual world busies himself with these, the spirit germ is all this time growing smaller and smaller until it returns to Mars and the actual sun sphere proper, and then passes quickly through the moon sphere to descend again to Earth for the next life. Some little time before man himself descends as soul being, he sends the spirit germ on in advance. He sends on that which he has prepared for his physical body some time before he himself descends into the physical world. He then finds himself in cosmic existence, in which, so to speak, he lays aside his work for the next earth life. By so doing, he is enabled to enter into quite a different relation to the cosmos from that hitherto existing. He is enabled to establish a relation to the entire cosmic ether. And, as the final act of his descent from the spiritual worlds, he draws forth from the whole cosmic ether the forces with which he then constructs his etheric body. Thus, when the spirit germ for his physical body is sent down, after many long years, during which the stream from the spiritual world has flowed into the parents for the physical body, part of the body, then man himself is still in the spiritual world, drawing the ether around him, so that for a brief while he is a being composed of ego, astral body, and ether, the ether being concentrated and drawn together. Only in the embryonic period, in the third or fourth week after conception, does man unite himself with what was formed during those first weeks from the union of the physical germ and spirit germ which had descended to earth earlier. He unites himself with this and endows it with the etheric body which he acquired by drawing it from the cosmic ether. Man then becomes a being consisting of that which had been sent down earlier, physical body, and etheric body which he collected, so to speak, at the last moment of his cosmic existence, astral body, and the ego which had gone through the life between death and a new birth. Thus man descends into a new life in the physical world, after having led a pure spiritual existence. From what has been said, it will be evident that man's experiences in passing through the world between death and a new birth consist in recollections of the earliest times of the earth's evolution, indeed the earliest times of what we may call the evolution of the world itself. Of course, these cosmic recollections of his, which indeed become his deeds, for he performs what he has to accomplish in cooperation with those higher beings of whom I have already spoken, and of whom I must speak further, these recollections become real and active, and what he then carries out forms an important perspective in the past of the earth and the cosmos. What man experiences while he stands in this relationship to the moon inhabitants brings back to his soul a time in his former earth life when he occupied the same position with respect to them. He looks back over a series of earth lives similar to the present time, and he then looks back yet further to an earth period in which he stood in closer relationship to the present moon inhabitants on the earth itself. He looks back to an age separated from him in his extra-physical existence by what the geologists call the glacial epoch. He looks back to a form of the Earth's evolution, which you will find described in my literature as the Atlantean epoch. He looks back further still, to what you will find described as the Lemurian epoch. The Earth was then under completely different conditions. Man was not then so earth-bound as to walk the Earth with his feet. At that time he lived more in the periphery of the Earth, in the atmosphere of the Earth itself, as an etheric being. This he could do because the atmosphere still contained all the water now distributed over the continents, and above all the other substances which have now become the solid earth of today were still part of the atmosphere. Man lived principally in the periphery, in the period which is called the Lemurian epoch. Here again the terminology used is not of much importance, but as the natural investigators call the oldest Earth epoch by that name, we also may use it. Beyond this, again, man looks back to an epoch when he was still united with the sun beings themselves, before that time in cosmic evolution when the sun separated from the earth. He looks back to that time which in my book, Esoteric Science, I have described as the sun period of the earth, the second of the earth's stages of development. He only looks back at the recapitulation in the earth existence of that cosmic evolution, but to that he can look back. When man's knowledge is perfected by what he can experience between death and his next birth, his human knowledge becomes to some degree cosmic knowledge. What formerly was the evolution of the earth arises in connection with the results of the repeated stages of earth life, in the human deeds which he accomplishes in cooperation with higher beings. The Earth's past, in its connection with the whole planetary system, sun, moon, and the planets pertaining to them, reappears in the deeds of man. And from what thus appears, man forms that part of his future which it is his business to form, his next Earth life. At the same time, he is also interwoven with the whole future which is being prepared for the world, the Jupiter, Venus, and Vulcan existences into which the earth will pass. When we contemplate these things, we can understand how it is that a part of the cosmic evolution of the earth was in a sense accomplished in those old cosmic epochs. We look back to a time when the present moon population gave earth men their teachers, and then withdrew into the moon citadel of the cosmos with the first great teachers of mankind, with the last of those great teachers. Over and over again, however, human beings were born on earth whose whole karmic life made it possible for them to remain in inner connection with the experiences of the moon inhabitants. These beings, who in the course of the earth evolution were born over and over again, appeared as ambassadors of the great assembly within the moon population, to those who peopled the earth in the first, second, and third post-Atlantean epochs of civilization, and evolved a higher civilization in the east. These ambassadors from the moon were called bodhisattvas. They were human beings on earth, but in them lived what was still directly spiritual, and which owed its presence on the earth to these great moon teachers. Times repeatedly occur in the universe when the moon inhabitants, being nearer to the sun inhabitants than are the people of earth, establish a very special inner relation to the former. Thus indirectly, through the moon ambassadors, known in the east as the bodhisattvas, the sun wisdom could also be brought to the humanity on earth during the older oriental civilizations. Then, however, because of the progress made in the evolution of earth, it became necessary that man should no more be nourished only by the beings of the moon. If it were always to happen that these moon messengers were to appear on earth, then its whole evolution would have had to follow a different course, one not predestined for it by cosmic wisdom. Hence the great and significant event which we designate as the mystery of Golgotha. While the moon ambassadors, in a sense, brought the sun wisdom to earth, it was the ruling sun being himself, he who is the leader of all the sun spirits, who descended to earth and went through the mystery of Golgotha and incarnated in the man Jesus. By reason of this, quite different conditions arose in earth evolution. That which the wisdom of the sun inhabitants has now become has been brought by Christ Jesus as an impulse into the earth evolution itself. And the rest of earth's evolution must run its course under the impulse of Christ Jesus. At the time, the mystery of Golgotha was fulfilled. There was still so much moon wisdom spread abroad on earth that the old moon wisdom as Gnosis, as Pistis Sophia, which is the old moon wisdom, could understand what Christ signified. That old moon wisdom was still there and appeared as the Gnosis. The Gnosis was chiefly an endeavor to understand Christ in his full spirituality, but it was rooted out. The first act of that evolution, which was based on a lack of understanding of the mystery of Golgotha, was to eradicate the Gnosis. And this was almost entirely destroyed, except for the writings of its antagonists. If nothing were to remain of the present anthroposophy, but what its opponents wrote about it, that would give us some idea of how much men really knew of the Gnosis from external knowledge. They knew nothing but what was said of it by its enemies, and the little contained in the Pistis Sophia, which they did not understand. That is all men knew of the Gnosis. The Gnosis was a moon gift from olden times to the early centuries of the Christian development, principally to the first 4 centuries. For after the 4th century, the Gnosis was no longer understood. It contained that which could, so to say, be spoken by the old moon wisdom, by the moon Logos, to the sun Logos, who had descended to earth, to the Christ. One who knows of this connection is really able to understand the Gnosis, which is so greatly misjudged, and of which such curious things are said at the present time. This state of things must not continue, for the earth's evolution must go on. We must really progress from the old moon wisdom to a new sun wisdom. We must acquire a direct understanding of the sun wisdom. In the next lecture, I shall explain in what fashion the old moon wisdom spoke to man after he had reached a certain conclusion, by means of a sort of yoga breathing, through a transmutation of the breathing process. By means of this, man worked his way through to the old moon wisdom. These yoga methods are not adapted to Western peoples, who must develop imagination in a direct manner. That is indeed the first stage which civilization in general must acquire, the attainment of imagination. There are, however, many difficulties in the way, and evolution can only continue in an upward direction for the civilization of mankind, if mankind will again accept a spiritual impulse. Its most intimate destinies are bound up with this. In all the ages in which the bodhisattvas appeared, they never encountered an unwilling humanity. Although men of old often seem to have been cruel and terrible, yet they were always able to meet with goodwill the impulses coming from the spiritual world. The bodhisattvas always encountered a humanity ready to accept that which was the logos of the moon, the reflection of the sun logos. Mankind is now changed, yet that which once existed lives on. So the old moon wisdom, the old moon logos, must not cease. It must continue, but must be grasped through the sun word, which, now that its last heritage has been lost in the Gnosis, must be discovered anew. Not till then can mankind be addressed in the true sun language, not till it brings goodwill to the sun word. Humanity may wait in vain for a successor of the old bodhisattvas, for the question as to whether one will appear or not depends upon whether or not men would encounter him with understanding. At the present time, mankind is sharply divided into an Eastern and a Western humanity. Anyone who does not look deeply enough into these circumstances often fails to form a right opinion as to this division, not realizing how the East awaits something from a new bodhisattva in a way which the West can but dimly surmise. The present nationalistic struggling has not yet been sufficiently overshadowed by that common consciousness of humanity which must spread over the whole earth as a result of the Christ impulse. Mankind will not be able to find the assent to this universal humanity, to this true Christian impulse, and will therefore not be able to understand what a possible bodhisattva has to say, until it once again develops within itself a sufficient degree of spiritual longing to enable it to form a bridge across the whole earth for an understanding between the East and the West. I have thus touched upon a subject which shall be continued tomorrow, and which must make essentially clear the fact that men are not compelled to wait for the bodhisattva. Rather must the bodhisattva wait for the necessary understanding on the part of mankind before he can speak to them in his own language, for man has entered the epoch of free will. More will be said on this very point of man having entered an epoch of free will in connection with the subject just touched upon, which will be continued tomorrow. All that man will have to go through in order really to find the way to the innermost impulse coming from the spiritual world is bound up with various systems of civilizations and symptoms of apparent insignificance. Forgive me for connecting the great things of which we have just been speaking with small things, but small things can be symptoms of great ones. Some days ago I said here that in this particular region, where the imaginations stand so firmly in the spirit, we have the disturbing influence of the motor car. I have nothing to say against motor cars, for as I have already mentioned, anthroposophy cannot speak in a reactionary sense. I myself am passionately fond of driving in a car when necessary. One must not wish to arrest the world's development, but must balance what comes from the one side by something else from the other. And it is therefore quite right to drive in motor cars. But to balance the motor traveling and everything connected with it, we must possess hearts yearning for the spiritual world. If that be so, no matter what other things of like kind may come along, man will be able to progress further of his own power and with the free will which must come, and which will then lead us again to the bodhisattva. Mankind will defend itself against those things of a mechanical nature which are placed in the world at its service. We may say that man will know how to defend himself against everything of a mechanical nature, such as cars and typewriters, etc. With the gramophone, it is a different thing. Forgive my concluding this lecture with what may seem to be so trivial a subject, but with the gramophone, man is trying to bring the mechanical into the realm of art. If mankind develops a passionate preference for such things, so that what descends into the world as the reflection of the spiritual is made mechanical, if mankind develops enthusiasm for such things as that, it will then be able to defend itself no longer. There will be no help to be found. Help can then only come from the gods. But the gods are merciful, and we today may hope that as regards the progress of the civilization of humanity, the merciful gods will themselves help it to overcome such aberrations as are expressed in the gramophone. The end of Lecture 11.